Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bolsevich. And now, here's Jay.
Good afternoon from beautiful downtown Elmira, Oregon. This is the Bo's Nose Show, and I'm Jay Bozovich, the West Lane County Commissioner here in Lane County, Oregon. And it is another gorgeous sunny afternoon in the Pacific Northwest. Blue sky, not a cloud out there. Breezy in the 70s. Just gotta love it. Feeling a little like fall, though, out there. And days are getting a little shorter. Dang. But if you don't have that, we wouldn't have apples and other things in the fall, so I'm good with it. So today is a free-for-all, which means you get to control the conversation. You can call in and we'll talk about anything you want to talk about. And you can call on 646-721-9887. And just press 1 if you want to join in on the conversation, and Robin, our call screener producer extraordinaire, will get you through to me, and we can have a conversation, or you can just email us at talk@krbnradio.net. And we've done a lot of, I was not around last week to do the show because I was up in Salem. It's kind of getting to be that time of year again where I end up the road in Salem quite a lot, more often to play defense on the county's behalf than to try and ask for things, so much play offense. But I was up there talking about PERS with a PERS task group. But we also had a couple board meetings since the last time we talked, and it's been a while since we had a free-for-all, so I got a whole bunch of topics to cover today. And besides PERS, before I get into that, I want to touch on something that we did yesterday, a board meeting, which was to take the local action necessary to enact a Senate bill that was passed in the 2016 session, Senate Bill 1513, which allowed counties to give a property tax exemption up to $250,000 worth of assessed value to the families or surviving family of a fallen police officer or firefighter killed in the line of duty. And it was, something that was pretty simple, easy thing for us to do at the county. And I really appreciate that the legislature, and this is one of the rare occasions where you see both houses voted unanimously, support from both Democrats and Republicans, unanimous support in both the House and the Senate, and signed by the governor, to provide counties the ability to do this, because they kind of control some of the tax law. We can't really give exemptions that aren't provided for in state law. And they put this law together, passed it unanimously. A couple other counties have jumped in and done what we did yesterday. Yesterday, we passed this on a unanimous 5-0 vote. And Officer Chris Kilcullen's widow, Christy Kilcullen, was there as we did this and spoke at the public hearing for the ordinance, because we have to do this by ordinance, which requires a public hearing. And it was very touching to have her there and to thank Gus for doing this. And I kind of feel like we have to thank her for the service of her husband and the ultimate sacrifice he gave in keeping our community safe. Chief Pete Kearns was there, and the Sheriff Byron Trapp was there. It was just a good and easy thing for the Board of Commissioners to do. And I want to also thank Commissioner Sid Lykin, who kind of shepherded it through on the board's behalf, and also some of our staff, and one of our newer staff members, who's also a reserve officer in the Oregon National Guard, helped shepherd this through on our staff, on the staff side of things. So just, it was one of those things where it was just An easy thing for me as a commissioner is sit up there and vote yes. And I don't take any credit for it because it's really something that the legislature provided to us, a very easy thing for us to do. Sid kind of led the charge in making sure that it got to the board and stat and with the help of certain staff. It was one of those things that you just like to do. It's a very small gesture, minimal cost to the county and the various taxing districts that we collect taxes for, because how often is there a fallen firefighter or a police officer's family that's going to be taking advantage of this? And compared to the overall tax base, it's minuscule. So something that was easy for us to do yesterday, made a lot of the TV news yesterday, but I really want to extend my appreciation to those firefighters and police officers and also the reserve officers that this bill covers. It's really them that we're showing the appreciation for. They're the ones that go out there every day knowing that they may not come home. It's one of those professions where there's that risk every day. And, you know, just a couple weekends ago, my wife and I flew into Dallas-Fort Worth Airport to do a trade show for her over the weekend. I got to be a booth babe. That's a whole other story for my wife's business. But as we were driving from Dallas-Fort Worth to the hotel where the trade show was being held, there was a huge traffic jam on one of the roadways going underneath the highway we were going on. And talk about highways, one of the highway leading to the airport there is like 18 lanes. It's double-deckered and everything. It's just amazing. But that's beside the point. Huge traffic jam. Turns out it was because there were two Fort Worth police officers that were shot in the line of duty as we were traveling into Dallas-Fort Worth that night. And that backup was created by the investigation and the tracking of trying to track down the suspect in the case, who they eventually caught the next day. So, you know, it's like brings it right home. Those guys every day, and that was a simple traffic stop, it turned out to be. That went wrong, more or less. And one of the officers involved in that was a training officer. He had only been on the job 8 months. So you can imagine, you know, that an officer in training, I should say, and a training officer that were both shot. Turned out that they both survived their wounds. But it's still, you know, that's what those guys put up with every day. And you know, even locally here, we had a fire recently on Fir Butte Road, which I talked about with Link Smith from the Oregon Department of Forestry a couple programs ago, where there was actually a firefighter that was temporarily hospitalized where that fire leaped around the crew that was trying to stop it at the time, and he was injured in the process. So, you know, fire is unpredictable. People are unpredictable. Those guys are the guys that step in where the rest of us are running away. They're running towards whatever's going on. It's just a small thing we could do to show our appreciation for those folks in a time where they're not getting a lot of appreciation. I feel like, you know, with everything going on in Charlotte and other areas of the country, it's nice to say thank you to those folks, in spite of everything else that's going on around the country. So, like I mentioned earlier, today is a free-for-all day. So if you have a topic you want to talk about or a question for me, you can call in at 646-721-9887 and just press 1, and that lets Robin know you want to ask a question, because people also use that line just to listen to the program if they're not at their computers. It's one of the ways you can listen to this program. So getting back to why I missed the program last week, I was up in Salem for a bipartisan task group, which is a non-legislative committee. It's kind of something that was started by a Democrat and a Republican senator, where they wanted to start the conversation again about PERS reforms. And we all know we've been down this road a couple times, and the last two times the legislature has tried to make PERS reforms, a good portion of those reforms have been struck down by the courts. So the kind of the question gets to be, what can we do about PERS? Because, you know, as everybody knows, we've got about $20 billion right now in unfunded liabilities. And just in the increase in rates to employers, this biennium is probably going to be another $800 million drag on Oregon's budget, in addition to what we're already paying in PERS employer contributions. So, you know, it's a serious issue for the state to try and address. But clearly, it's one that is really hard to struggle with, because, you know, how do you really make a change that can be legal? And they tried to have some legal look in advance by the legislative legal counsel to make some recommendations as to what they think might actually pass muster with the courts. And I have my doubts about what the legislative counsel actually said, you know, that they thought might pass muster. But we can talk about a few of those and how they might impact PERS rates. I can tell you a couple things that are available that will pass muster with the courts, because they have before, or that they're strictly in the control of the PERS board and the legislature. One of the first things they can do is reduce the assumed rate of return on investments for both the employer's contributions that are being held to pay future benefits, and it also affects the rate of return back on the what they call the variable rate accounts of PERS members. The current rate is 7.75%, and it used to be 8%, so they finally lowered it a little bit. But I've talked to all sorts of professionals that are in the investment business, and particularly in retirement investments, you know, folks from all the usual suspects, Edward Jones, Merrill Lynch, you know, Northwestern Mutual. You know, I've got, you know, my own advisors, and I've got friends, you know, even if you talk with, almost anyone you talk to, 8% is an unreasonable rate of return to expect on a long-term investment. And the fact that the PERS board has actually been able to hit that several times over the last several years is nothing short of amazing, and is gambling at best. And to consider 8% to be a long-term rate of, even a 7.75 to be a long-term return on investment, is something that the legislature could actually direct the PERS board to start reducing right now. And there is nothing in a legally binding contract with PERS members that requires them to hold that rate. One of the reasons why they're reluctant to do that is because if you lower that assumed rate, that means that most of the agencies that are PERS agencies, like school districts, their current PERS rates are based on that high rate of return on whatever they already have in the PERS bank. And if you're not getting that much back on the investment, that means you got to put more cash in now. So as you lower that assumed rate, it also raises the rates on the school districts and the state and everyone else. So they kind of are artificially and hiding the real cost of PERS to the public by holding that assumed rate up real high. At the same time, it also raises the benefit level to the PERS members. So it has a down the road impact on how much PERS is going to cost, but it prevents the impact in today's budget, which is, I think, kind of hiding the real cost of PERS to the public and not a good thing to do. So if it were up to me, I would lower that rate at least a quarter point every year until it gets down to a reasonable long-term assumed rate of return, which would be somewhere down between 4 and 5% when you talk to most investment professionals. And that would really get it to where it should be. Problem is that's going to make agencies' rates go up over the long run. What it will do, though, is when you look out about 20 years, it will greatly lower the payouts to PERS members 20 to 30 years out. It won't have a real immediate effect. It has a long-term effect on the payouts. So it would ultimately start correcting the problem. And I think in some ways, it would bring the problem home to the taxpayers when they start having to see school districts and cities and the state start budgeting for the real cost of what they've already committed to in PERS. If they start lowering those rates to where they should be. If they don't, it's going to be one of these things where we're going to be assuming this 7.75 rate of return. We have a year where we turn in only a 3 or 4% return on the PERS investments. And next thing you know, the unfunded liability goes from $20 billion to $30, $40, $50 billion because we're not keeping up on that side. It's just a false sense of security by having the rate be so high. So gradually lowering it, I think, is something that the legislature could do and something that I testified to the two senators that I thought they should start doing. The other thing I think they could do is require public agencies to actually fully fund their liabilities, or at least fund at a minimum level 80%, if not 90% of their liabilities. There are some agencies out there, school districts in particular are guilty of this, that are well below 80% funded, as low as 60% funded. And that's allowed them to basically deficit spend. They're spending money they don't have in their current year operating budget when they should be setting aside the money that they've committed to pay their retirees in the future, or at least enough to be invested at a reasonable rate of return to actually make good on those promises they've made to their retirees. So this allowing for this deficit spending is another way they've hidden the cost of PERS from the voting public, and the folks, you know, think they're still, you know, doing somewhat okay in these agencies. They really need to be funding at least at 80%, if not 90%, and there should be some requirements for these agencies to catch up and get to that level. And what you would see is there'd suddenly be this panic in some agencies that have underfunded their PERS. And the public would suddenly realize when they start talking about, oh my gosh, we're going to have to cut, you know, 10 teachers from our staff and 5 school days and this, that, and the other thing, they'd be like, oh my God, this PERS thing's a real problem. We need to deal with it. And there might be some political will to start dealing with this on all sides, and some pressures on you know, the PERS members and the agent PERS agencies to come together and find a decent set of reforms that will pass judicial muster. So that's, you know, and I want to add to this conversation, Lane County has been funding their PERS obligation at a higher level than most agencies. At one point, we were well above 95% funded. With some of the way the investments have gone, we dropped below for a little while, but we are funded at a level above 80%. And because of that, we've actually kept our PERS rates lower than some agencies. But the PERS board only will they won't really try and force an agency to catch up. They'll only do a certain percentage increase on an agency, and I think that needs to change. We need to hold these school districts and cities and everyone else that's been underfunding their PERS liabilities, including the state, accountable to do real budgeting and not high deficit spending by allowing this unfunded liability to sit out there on their books and not show up in their operational spending. Because basically they've been deficit spending and building up a future debt, and that's against state law. We are not allowed to deficit spend. We don't print money like the federal government. So something has to change in that. So my two easily done and ultimately defendable in court things you could do with PERS is start lowering the assumed rate, because that saves us money in the long run, and start requiring agencies to budget for their PERS liabilities like they should be, instead of deficit spending and hiding it in an unfunded liability. So easy things to do. Unfortunately, both of those things are going to require spending cuts on the part of the agencies and start feeling the real pain that this is costing us. And ultimately, that'll be another thing. Another thing that the legislature could do, which they haven't done, is give local governments the ability to declare bankruptcy. Most people don't know this, but in the state of Oregon, when they changed the bankruptcy laws, I think back in the 90s, might have even been as far back as the 80s, states kind of had to decide whether they were going to allow all public entities to declare bankruptcy and specifically limit them and say which ones could not, or they could say you're not allowed to declare bankruptcy unless we specifically list you as allowing. Well, the state of Oregon did the second half, and the only ones they had specifically listed in statute at the time that could declare bankruptcy were irrigation districts. So right now, the only agency that can declare bankruptcy and use bankruptcy as a way of fixing their finances in this state are irrigation districts. There's no way for a city or a county or a special district like a water district to declare bankruptcy to try and reorganize their debt, reorganize their labor contract, and to come back and be financially strong if they totally implode. And this is particularly interesting for those Southwest Oregon counties, and Lane County is not far from this, that were so timber dependent and under Measure 5 got limited in their ability to tax, that they just are close to bankruptcy anyway. So it's really one of those things that would be easy for the legislature to pass a law allowing school districts, special districts, municipalities, and counties to have some form of bankruptcy protection where we could reorganize ourselves under bankruptcy. Right now, I don't know if a county runs out of money, there's no provision in state law how to handle that in any way, which means we do not have the ability or the threat with our public unions that we negotiate with, that if they go too far, we can go to bankruptcy and start over, you know. And when it comes to PERS, that may be one of the ultimate ways that you deal with your obligation, you know, over-obligating to your retirees, is you have, you know, the only way you can change a contract really is through a bankruptcy court. Doesn't give you carte blanche, but it may be one of the ways we get to some place where we can actually afford to pay for some of the promises that were made and mistakes that were made back in the 90s. A lot of those mistakes got corrected. In 1996, they brought in Tier 2, which made a major change in PERS and corrected a lot of the liability. And then they brought in Tier 3 in 2003, I think. And that basically turned PERS from a defined contribution to defined benefit to a defined contribution plan, and really got rid of most of the PERS liability in the Tier 3 system. So going forward with any new employee into state and local government in Oregon, those new employees aren't the problem. It's the folks that like me, I'm a Tier 2 employee, that some of those promises made in certain circumstances can really be quite expensive. But they were contractual, according to the courts. So how we handle the PERS situation is going to be a really interesting thing coming up through this next legislative session. Didn't hear much proposals there in Salem that day that sounded like they were going to fly through the courts. And it'll be interesting to see how this all goes. But, you know, if you have any questions about PERS and how it works or what might be legal or not legal, I'm sitting on a notebook full of legal opinions from both the union attorneys and from the state legislative council. I got some help from some local attorneys providing me some opinion work before I went up there. We can talk about the legal intricacies and what might be contractual and not contractual under the implied contract of a retirement system. But we can get into all that. But you have to call me though to get in on the conversation. And to call me, you need to dial 646-721-9887 and just press 1. And that lets Robin know that you want to talk to me, and we'll get you on the air. And, you know, it doesn't have to be about PERS. It can be about anything, because this is a free-for-all day, and it's your day to talk to your commissioner and quiz me about whatever you want to talk about. And we can get into state politics and national politics, too. But I will say one thing. I did not watch the debate, so don't ask me about the debate. I was in Florence at a forest assessment meeting with ODF, attending a public meeting there with a few other people that weren't watching the debate. And that public meeting was scheduled long before the National Debate Coalition or whatever puts on the presidential debates decided on their dates. So sorry, I missed the presidential debate. I'm not one of the 85 million that tuned in. And of course, I think that was 85 million for at least the first 5 minutes before most people got fed up and changed the channel and watched football. So you can call and we can talk about anything, but I won't be able to offer very many good opinions on the presidential debate because I didn't watch it. But I do have opinions about the presidential race. If you want to hear those, you can ask. So again, that's 646-721-9887. Press 1 to get in. You can also email us at talk@krbnradio.net. So some of the other things that have been going on with the Board of Commissioners hasn't just been about PERS reform. We talked about tobacco a bit yesterday, and that kind of made the news this morning somewhat. There's a proposal from our folks in our health department, and it's coming through our Parks Advisory Committee too, where they want to ban smoking in parks. And it's really one of those things that's pretty easy to say, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Why don't we just ban folks from smoking in parks? You know, the 75 to 80% of us that don't use tobacco products, we don't like them. We're the majority. We'll just throw them out. Unfortunately, that doesn't make for good law. I always believe that one of the duties I have is to the Constitution of the United States and the state. And part of that is you got to protect an unpopular minority sometimes. And smokers have every right to use our parks as anyone else does until we declare that smoking is illegal for adults in this country. So I kind of had a problem with moving a parks ban forward, and there were lots of reasons why. And we can get into some of the details of that here. But I just got flagged by Robin. She had something she wanted to chime in on. I don't know if it was about PERS or tobacco, but Robin, is there something you had a question about or comment?
I always got something to say.
Okay.
First of all, again, publicly, congratulations to you and the other Board of Commissioners on the property tax and, you know, for the spouses of fallen police officers. I think that was a really great thing to do.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we just got to pass the ordinance that was really originated in the legislature. It's one of the few times where I'll say kudos to the legislature, you know, and they gave us the tool. We just used it. And I got to sit there and vote yes and look like I did a great thing, but the real work got done up in the legislature to give us that tool.
Well, it's kind of nice that they finally moved beyond focusing on electing the border collie as our state dog and did something worthwhile for change.
I'd rather be the standard poodle anyway, but
yeah, and that's actually true too. What they did, nice to do that to an emergency session, but they're always good for.
I think we've got a state rock and a state mineral and a few other things they've done in the middle of sessions where you're going, oh my gosh, don't they have anything else better to do?
Exactly. I'd love to do a live commentary from there because I'm also sure they have a state cigarette, and you can bet it's not. Well, I guess it's now legal. Because they must be smoking something. Going back to the bankruptcy situation, brings to mind, I think, and now correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't some of the, like I think City of Eugene, for example, isn't it in the city's constitution or a city charter where they are not allowed to run a deficit?
Well, actually, that's in Oregon budget law.
Oh, is it?
And you're not allowed to run a deficit as a subdivision of the state or an agency of a public agency in this state. You can't, and it's something you can't do. And that's what gets me about these folks that aren't funding their PERS liabilities, because technically, they're deficit spending. They're ignoring a liability they've committed to contractually, and not putting enough money into the system to make up for that, and they're spending it on their daily operations. So they're, you know, keeping folks on staff that they should be laying off to pay for their previous liabilities, and those folks they're keeping on staff are adding to that liability. You know, it's a shell game of getting around the state law on deficit spending.
Exactly. Brings up, was it Measure 97, which they haven't really committed to where those funds are going?
No, yeah, and you can bet that those Measure 97 funds, the majority of where they're going to go is going to be to pay for the PERS liabilities and to pay for the fact that they started this Oregon Health Plan expansion of Medicaid that they knew was not going to be supported by the federal government, and there was a taper down involved. And this biennium is only the first part of the taper down that's creating a $1.2 billion deficit. It's going to be a couple billion dollars beyond that, like about two and a half in the next biennium. Because the federal government basically said, we'll spike this Medicaid expansion the first 2 years and give states a bunch of extra money to roll this out and expand the roles of Medicaid and get all these people enrolled. But we're going to taper down. It's going to be up to the states to figure out that supposedly with all the cost savings you're going to get, you'll be able to make up for our taper down of the money. Well, the cost savings haven't materialized. And so really what that Measure 97 will end up doing is paying for the lack of cost savings in Obamacare and for the underfunding of the PERS liability by the state. And it won't help any kids get higher grades in and better graduation rates in school, and it won't help get any more patrol officers out on our interstates to make them safer. You know, it's not going to do any of those things we really think and they're telling us it's going to do. It's, you know, I can tell you that a good $2 billion of it is already spent in the projected deficit for the upcoming budget. And they say it's going to raise $3 billion. I really don't see them getting to $3 billion with this, because I think one of the things they haven't built into that projection is people are going to find ways to avoid paying that tax.
Well, why don't we just follow the Obamacare example, is that, we'll just pass a law. You know, we'll make it illegal to be sick. We'll make it illegal to not have any money. We'll make it illegal to just, you know, same example. They don't have health care. We'll make it mandatory. We'll just make everything, you know, we'll just pass a law, fix everything.
Yeah, because it's working so well.
Exactly. That's why next year scares me.
Yep. So it's really some scary times out there somewhat. Yeah. You know, Measure 97, we can talk about that a little bit because it's kind of been in the news some. And you're starting to see the ads for it. Well, I know a particular company that has over $25 million in Oregon revenue, but it's a company that's controlled mostly by a family. But it's a C corporation right now because that provides probably the best, you know, tax benefits right now of a company that size, and also liability protections, et cetera. The family that is involved in this company is, if Measure 97 passes, they're going to convert it to an S corp. So Measure 97 specifically is about taxing C corporations, you know, under that part of the, you know, incorporated under that part of the U.S. code, not S corporations. So there's a very large company that, just by changing their organizational structure, is not going to be paying that tax.
Right.
Which kind of leads to the, you know, where's the fairness in that taxation system? What about some of these large grocery chains? I'm not sure all of them are organized as C corps. Some of them may be a different entity. You know, there's not always a C corp behind some of these large. So, you know, when one company might have to raise all their food prices by 2.5%, and another company might not, you know, it's going to tilt the table to where, you know, you may see companies leave Oregon.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to ask, is that if you're a CEO of a company and you're looking at expanding to another state and you're hearing about Measure 97, are you going to kind of like maybe have second thoughts about Oregon?
Oh, yeah. We're already, you know, one of the things as a commissioner I get involved in is in the recruitment of companies coming to Oregon, or in trying to keep somebody here in Oregon. And that can get to be a pretty tricky thing sometimes when we start the uncertainty about a law that might pass. Mm-hmm. Can get you to a point where folks, that uncertainty is enough almost to make them decide to go to another jurisdiction.
Exactly. By the way, I'd like to remind folks that 646-721-9887, if you'd like to talk to Jay and get in on the conversation, just press 1 on your touch phone and touchpad, and you enter the conversation.
Yeah. Got to press that one because that kind of puts the flag up on our board that you want to get in on the conversation versus just listening to the program, which some people will do and call in and just listen. So it lets us know the difference between a listener and somebody that actually wants to get in on talk.
Yeah, that's right. And Jay, I'm going to take a chance here. Just go ahead and go hot. And caller, welcome to the program. May I have your first name, please?
Yes, my name is Rose.
Hi, Rose. How you doing?
Is this Jay?
This is Jay.
Who is this? Okay. I thought maybe it's time for a break in all the big, huge money affairs all the way around us in our lives and just zero in back to the police department.
Yeah.
My question to you, are you there? Can you hear me or is this too loud or too low?
Yeah, I can hear you. No, I can hear you.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to continue on. I hope to make some sense here really quick. I like to kind of get back to an issue which has been plaguing me personally for the last 5 years. I know that you are aware where I live, so I am not going to name any titles or any names in order to protect everyone and ourselves and myself from any, kind of retaliatory actions. My neighborhood is really in bad shape. And I wanted to have a question discussed here with you that I've been having always to want to ask. The police department has not confiscated the gentleman or man or veteran that lives next to me. He has been shooting here over the past 6 weeks, 3 times. I had the police out here twice. And they knocked on his door and talked to him. The man needs to be removed from the society of people that live here a normal life, at least are trying to live a normal life. We have paid taxes, homeowners. And I am just kind of really worried about why the police department does not confiscate his pellet gun. He also killed one of my cats 5 years ago. That has been reported to the police department, and I have this all on paper. So that's my question. How can this man be removed? I mean, ASAP. That's my question.
Oh, well, that's an intricate question, because what you're getting into is you basically have to show that person, at least is mental health wise, is...
Oh, he is totally in a bad shape. Yes.
Yeah, and he probably is, but this is one of the things that's been going back and forth in America for quite a while, and I've run into this with...
Yes.
Some other people with that I've tried to help in this country. We assume everybody's got a basic set of rights, and one of those rights kind of is you kind of have a right to be a little bit crazy, even if people might think you're weird or whatever else, but you're allowed to be crazy up to a point where you're either a danger to other people or yourself. And what you have what you have to do is be get some authority to say this person's a danger to themselves or a danger to society, and they need to be forcibly taken into custody until they're stable or put into treatment. That system has gotten broken in a lot of ways in our society. It used to be overused. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
yes,
which was actually filmed in our old state hospital here in Salem.
Well, you know what? He's over it about at least 10 times over the cuckoo's nest.
Yeah. And he may be, but what's happened is, we used to basically warehouse mentally ill people, and but we violated a lot of people's rights and we were putting people in institutions that really didn't need to be there, you know, kind of like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So
yeah, no, I follow
that
you.
Was,
I follow you.
That was the pendulum way over on that side. And what's happened over the years and with lawsuits and laws and court cases, now the pendulum's way over on the other side, where it is very difficult for a public agency, particularly a police department, to take somebody into custody purely on the fact that they're mentally unstable. They need an order from either a court, or they need an order from the mental health director from the county, or from a hospital or a doctor, saying that this person is, and not just a danger to themselves and their neighbors, but they have to be in an imminant danger to themselves or their neighbors.
But listen, Jay, please. Listen to this. I am in danger. I am right next to this man. I am in danger. Yeah. I have told the police department that over and over, and they need to respond in a better way to remove someone like that because of threat to someone else's life. He could shoot anybody by just coming outside and using his pellet gun to just kind of play big shot. He doesn't even know what the hell he's doing. He doesn't know how to walk. He doesn't know how to talk. He is into the drugs. Have license plates that I have already given to the police department just a week ago. I need somebody to follow up on this situation.
Well, tell you what, Rose, I'll give you a call tomorrow morning.
Yeah, we're going to talk off the air. We're going to talk off the air.
We need to talk off the air because I think it's going to take something like a director's hold from our mental health director or some other thing to...
Yes, something. The Cahoots Wagon was just here 3 days ago, and I'm going to call you back, or you can call me back when you're off the air, and we can talk about it sometime in the next couple of days.
Right. Yeah, there are some ways to probably get to that, but I think we're not going to be able to solve it on the air today, but part of the issue with that, and for anyone that's listening that might be dealing with somebody... I've gone through some of these frustrations with an elderly homeless person that I was having trouble getting committed into care because she wasn't, quote, an imminent danger to herself. Everyone agreed that ultimately she would die if she didn't get into some kind of housing because, unfortunately, her physical condition, she was getting to the point where she was incontinent in the middle of winter, so she's sleeping in wet bedding materials in wintertime. And it was, I had difficulty getting that woman help.
I understand that. I understand that. I'm going to make some more room for you for another caller to talk to you about different matters, because I cannot really get all that thorough about the whole thing online anyway.
Right. Yeah. And I appreciate it, Rose, but hang in there.
No, I understand.
We'll see if we can get a little bit of help, maybe from some of the mental health agencies, and see if we can.
He needs to be, let go of this situation where he lives right here, and he needs to have some help, and it has to be done very soon. So I want to thank you for being such a sweet person, and generally speaking. And I thank you for your time, and I'll make some room for the next caller.
All right. Thank you, Rose. Thanks for calling.
Sure.
So,
right.
For those of you that just to explain, I've known Rose for probably almost 20 years now. At one time, she was a piano teacher of mine. So, obviously, her voice is very recognizable. But Rose is one of these great characters that I love, and a sweet person. But she used to play piano on cruise ships. Very skilled piano player and a generally nice person. But she's got all these great photos of herself with these various celebrities that also were on the cruise ships doing, from Harry Belafonte and a whole bunch of other people. Neat person to meet and talk to. And obviously, not originally an American citizen. She's originally from Germany, as you could tell from the accent. But lovely person. Thank you for calling, Rose. I'll try and help you with your neighbor off the air, and particularly when I can get a hold of somebody at the county during business hours to try and see if we can work with mental health and maybe cahoots to help your neighbor. So we have about 10 minutes left in the show, and Robin, we were kind of in the middle of a conversation. Did we get where you wanted to go with that about bankruptcy and PERS and a few other things, or did you have something else you wanted to add?
I think we pretty much covered that. I was going to comment, though, that even though you missed the debate, I didn't watch it live. I watched a replay. And to sum up, basically, they act like they were married to each other.
Yeah. I could get that from some of the sound bites I heard on various programs. Television and radio the last couple of days, it did sound like a married couple bickering.
Yeah.
Why don't you just blame me for everything? Why not?
Sure.
It does sound like an old married couple.
Yeah. Well, the positive side, I know you didn't see it, but because it's just having one moderator and the guy did kind of let them talk between the two, you have a two-way dialogue. I did kind of like that exchange better, though.
Yeah. And, you know, in the old days, there was no moderator in debates.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish they'd almost go back to that format in some ways, where it's a true one-on-one debate. But, yeah, I don't think we learned a whole lot from that debate. I will say, just from the sound bites I've seen and the clips I've seen, it seemed like maybe that Hillary, if I was, you're going to grade the debates or something, she came off a little bit better in that she did a couple things successfully. One, I think she showed that she had the ability to stand there and talk for an hour, not cough, faint, or fall over or trip or stumble. And that was something very important for her to show the nation. It sounds like she was able in the last portion of the debate, from what I understand, to goad Donald Trump into kind of getting a little bit angry and showing some of that side of him just by her constant personal attacks against him. My wife watched it, and her basic takeaway was, you know, maybe Hillary came out a little bit ahead, but she came off sounding really mean at times.
She looks like a to me, because she was just laughing and smiling, just whatever. But I think what we should do is get a hold of Vince McMahon and put her and Trump in the ring for an hour and a half.
Yeah, and have him do the ringside announce. Yeah, the in this corner.
Weighing in at 3,700 emails.
We're in a tent.
Yes, she helps the garment industry.
Yeah, and in the other corner, keeping the spray tan industry alive.
Her really great, really great, great opponent. It's going to be a really great show.
It's going to be huge.
Huge. It's going to be so huge.
And beautiful.
And beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. Oh, God. And the clip about him having the temperament at the end, towards the end of the debate, was an interesting clip.
Yeah.
That's my strongest point, my temperament.
Well, what's funny is that the New Yorker came out with a parody article, and it's already showing up on Facebook, and some people are treating it as the real deal, even though in the article it says, for the real article, go to here.
I always love it when somebody forwards me an Onion headline thinking it's a real headline.
Yeah, they're focusing on, you know, Trump saying, well, I really didn't get I wish they split the screen. They should have stayed on me so I can show them my temperament.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did hear that CNN's coverage, where they stayed on a split screen the entire 90 minutes, was actually the best coverage, because they didn't actually show the moderator at all. So you got to see the facial reactions to when the other one said something, you know, the eye rolling or whatever.
Oh, I love that. That's what I was saying about watching Hillary. When Trump is responding, she's sitting there laughing like the Joker. Mm. And it's like, what are you? I'd love to know what she was thinking. It's like, can I just get through this? I know it's rigged.
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I tell you, it's an interesting year, but I have a feeling, you know, and I heard this today, that people are not understanding that the folks that support Donald Trump aren't grading the debate like we would normally grade debates between two politicians.
Right.
Because they don't really care about being like a politician. So the Trump supporters thought he won. You know, and they were fine with his performance. So it's an interesting world we live in, and it'll be interesting to see how this. I could no more predict the election today from, you know, I don't think polls are accurate, because I think this is so unpredictable. I don't think polling is very accurate in this one. It's going to be pretty interesting. That's that. You know, we kind of got started talking about uncertainty with businesses before Rose called. And I think this election is raising a lot of uncertainty for the business community.
Well, and I think what you're saying about the polls is that they're, and this is brought up last week on talk shows, that people are, they'll say they're not for Trump, but they're afraid to say, because there's so much, it's kind of embarrassing to say you're for Trump, even if you're for Trump. And
yeah.
I've had people tell me, you know, because I like to look at as much of the facts as possible, and I've sat through a lot of congressional hearings. Oh, God, that's talk about boring. You know, getting the facts. But when somebody says, well, you're for Trump, and I respond, well, that makes you for Clinton. No, I'm not. Yeah. You only have a choice of two people.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always Gary Johnson.
Yeah, but even if he was like Ross Perot, you know, as popular as Ross Perot was, he got zero electoral votes, and that is what elects the president.
Yep. This is true, and not that I would ever change the electoral college system. I think it's a very good system. We're down to almost a binary choice at this point. I'd be one of those people that if you polled me a couple weeks back, you know, even a month or two back, I just can't bring myself to vote for Donald Trump. You know, I would have said I'm undecided. I wouldn't have said Hillary or Trump. I'm starting to sit here and go, okay, who do I want appointing Supreme Court justices? and that's kind of, you know, I'm at the Ted Cruz point where it's like, okay, I guess I'm going to end up voting for Trump, because I think hopefully he'll gather some people around him that'll give him a better list than Hillary will get from her people. And that's what it comes down to. Who's going to be on the Supreme Court for the rest of their life, because it's lifetime appointments, which is a whole other discussion, maybe for another day on the Bo's Nose Show. As we're wrapping up today, we never did get around to talking too much about tobacco or roadside spraying or forest assessments or even flashing beacons at crosswalks, which I had on my list. So we're going to have another free-for-all day, and we'll try and get to some of those comments, conversations. But, you know, really need you guys to call, because this is your show. 646-721-9887 next week to get a hold of me. But I will be back next week with the Bo's Nose Show here from beautiful downtown Elmira in the Pacific Northwest, where the weather is gorgeous and the beer is good. Talk good night from the Bo's Nose Show.